Welcome back, everyone, to the Austinpreneur Podcast. We're recording at Capital Factory House amidst South by Southwest 2025. We've got a pretty awesome guest I'm excited to talk to today, Steven Simone. He's the CEO of Allen Control Systems, one of the newest portfolio companies we have at Capital Factory. Steven served in the U.S. Navy as a nuclear engineer, and after the Navy transitioned to the tech industry, he's worked on a few ventures and then ultimately started a company called Bebot, which was acquired by DoorDash. Today, he's CEO of Allen Control Systems, which I mentioned, where they're using AI to shoot drones out of the sky. Welcome, Steven, to the Austin Career Podcast.
Thanks, Nick, for having me. Appreciate that.
Welcome to Austinpreneur, our show about the stories that made Austin, Texas, a global hub for startups. The show is produced by Capital Factory and hosted by me, Nick Spiller. As a reminder, by joining Capital Factory, you can plug into the ecosystem where the stories on the show were set. Learn more about us at capitalfactory.com.
Well, let's just start, you know, for those of you or for those out there listening, you know, just think of drones as, you know, taking pictures at birthday parties, you know, like let's set the context of how drones are being used in the battlefield and other critical areas.
Oh, yeah. I mean, taking a step back, though, I think it's good to like kind of do the history lesson of where they come from.
Yeah.
From a great, phenomenal entrepreneur named Frank. He's from China, but he started DJI in his dorm room as an entrepreneur. And he was, you know, backed by some U.S. money, you know, different kinds of money, U.S. investment and stuff too. But he was able to build that. He kind of saw it ahead of everyone that drones were going to be some of the most important things to shape the world. And so, you know, when they first started, it was like a toy, you know, pretty small. It got started. It was like probably 2001, early 2000s. He built that up over 20 years to be the largest drone maker in the world. It, you know, it makes 70% of all the world's drones. Yeah, it's incredible. And so great entrepreneurship, though. It would have been nice to have that to be a U.S. entrepreneur.
That's right.
You know?
And so that's a Chinese-based company, correct?
Well, yeah, exactly. So it's in Shenzhen, and it's one of the best companies in the world. And, you know, one of the things, maybe, I don't even know if the founder knew this at the time, but these toys are now weapons of war. Yep. You know, you just put a little bomb on them or a grenade.
Right.
They're $1,000. You can, you know, makeshift do them. They do them in the front lines of Ukraine, right. Front lines on the Ukraine-Russia conflict.
And was that where we really started seeing the rubber hit the road with drone wars?
Actually, I mean, the first drone war was in Azure. Like the first like fully drone war, according to some experts, was a book called 7 Seconds to Die about the Armenia-Azerbaijan war, probably like late 2010s, I would say, where the Azerbaijanis basically melted the Armenians in 44 days with just drones. And they televised it all too on social media. So every drone has a camera. And like in the future, pretty much all war will be televised because every product has a camera now. So like what they would do is they would use drone strikes with the cameras and then they would show like the live kills and then they would post it to Armenian social media to humiliate the population. Mm. And the population would be like, well, fuck that. We're out. Yeah. Surrender.
Yeah.
It's done.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so there's this media aspect to it where these things are connected and we're getting not just a way to drop, you know, bombs cheaper, but you actually got these nice.
Yeah, I think there is going to be, I mean, I don't know. I can't really see the future. It's, I mean, I guess that's what I'm paid to try to do, but no one really can.
Right.
You'd be rich.
Sure.
But like with all of the products besides not just drones, but all of these new robotic systems that are hitting the battlefield, everything's like using computer vision to do navigation and, you know, tracking and strike. And so if everything has a camera on it, it's just kind of natural that, well, maybe in the future, there's like a sci-fi world where we're all just kind of watching like a Twitch for war type thing.
Yeah. And then how were drones used in Ukraine?
I mean, right now, like, well, there's different types of drones. There's like the ones that fly really high in the sky that, you know, do surveillance.
Sure.
Then there's the Iranian Shahed, which is the most common Group 3 kamikaze drone. It's like, you know, wingspan like my arms. Little, maybe a little bigger. I'm not that big, but a little bigger than this. And then there's kind of fly in and try to just like, they dumbly just fly in and try to hit something and blow up like a building.
Yeah.
They're like $40,000 or so, or well, the reports vary. some U.S. companies like to say they're more expensive than they really are, I think, because like because the U.S. products to defend against them are expensive. So it's like for these vendors, they're incentivized to say that the Iranian Shahed costs more so they don't look bad.
Yeah.
But I mean, honestly, it's probably like 50, 60 grand. I saw one on Alibaba. You can like buy it on Alibaba.
Right.
So anyways, let's call it 50 grand. That's the Iranian Shahed. And then there's like the little drones, the DJI type, the low flying drones that have, you know, cost anywhere from $500 to $2,000. They have little, you can strap a bomb to them and those, you know, those fly out and try to hit some people or hit like a piece of artillery. There's one. So there's various types of drones.
And is there any particular level of those three that, you know, is, I think, most impactful and most maybe most disruptive in the battlefield?
Well, it depends on the battlefield. So in Israel-Iran conflict, it's a group three war.
Yeah.
So group three war is just like they're sitting back. I mean, if you, you know, if you can envision where they are geographically on Earth, they kind of are a little far away. So they just kind of, Iranians lob in Iranian Shaheds. Like, I think last April, they did like 148 in one strike. And then they sit back in their home territory. And then the Israelis try to shoot missiles at those. And it's like kind of a game of economics.
Yeah.
So obviously the Iranians are winning that game currently because it's cheaper for them to send them.
Right.
Attacking's easier.
Right.
If you ever play StarCraft, you want to be on the attack. Like defending sucks, basically. And in Ukraine, it's like a group one, group two war where it's they're entrenched battle lines and you got low flying drones. They're spooling out on fiber optic cables and just like trying to get into the trenches. So that's like a, that's a more of a different kind of conflict. So it depends on the region. And China will be, and China, Taiwan would be different too.
Yeah. How are drones being used on the border?
Cartels are using drones like, you know, to attack the CBP, the border protection people. So you can smuggle drugs, that stuff, you know, strapping bombs. They're strapping IEDs to those and running them into CBP agents.
That's happening today.
Yeah. And so, we're looking for some defenses down there.
Yeah.
I know like a lot of border people are trying to do that. Yeah.
So talk us through your approach to counter UAS at Allen Control System.
Yeah. So basically our approach is that we weren't going to be able to manufacture like DJI. Like that company is really far ahead. It's not like there's an American company that's anywhere close to the scale of this Chinese company. And there really won't be for probably ever, just based on how our policy, you know, how we're working right now. So we thought, okay, if we can't do that, why don't we just try to shoot them with bullets? Very simple concept. You know, a bullet costs $1, a drone's like $1,000. So if you can create a precision robotics system that can, you know, point and aim better than any human could, then you're in business. So I'll let you know if the business is good. I don't know yet. We'll find out.
So you just shoot them out of the sky.
Yeah, if you can. And so the nice thing about drones, when you put a bomb on them, they become really a lot less maneuverable.
Yeah.
Like you can't, like if you've seen a drone racer, like on TV, like the drone racer kids that do like FPV racing, those are hard. They would be hard to hit, but they're like small and they have no payload.
Yeah.
So once you put a payload on it, then the robotics problem becomes easier. So they're, you can hit them with bullets. We're doing that now.
Sure. Yep. What range can you hit a drone from?
Yeah. I mean like 3 football fields away with like 2 or 3 shots. Yeah, it's no human could ever do this. Yeah, it's actually pretty scary. Yeah.
What type of shell are you using?
7.62 round. It's like this big.
So it's pretty sizable, right?
Yeah, it's fine.
And then how many drones could one of, it's called the bullfrog, correct?
Yeah, bullfrog, because it's like, if you can imagine like a bullfrog's tongue, like licking.
Yeah.
Because like most, it's like a, you just like 1 or 2 shots. It's like a sniper. Because most product, there's actually a history of these kind of guns. There's a product, so I was a naval officer.
Right.
The product called the SeaWiz. It's like a little R2-D2 looking thing on the top of a cruiser. But what that does is like intercepts incoming missiles to the ship with bullets. But the way that works is because it's an old technology, they just spray like a bullet cloud into the air. It's literate with bullets and then the missile like intercepts it.
Or the shotgun approach.
Yeah, just like, well,
extreme.
Yeah, just spray rounds into the air in that general vicinity.
Yeah.
So that's not the imagery we wanted to evoke with the product name. So like bullfrogs kind of like they hang out in the mud, they're like short and stout, and then they can lick you.
Very precise.
Yeah, they're just licking these drones.
Right.
And so what role is AI playing on the bullfrog?
I mean, it's all over it. It's not the AI you would, it's not like the LLM stuff. Like that's all like, you know, that's a different use case of AI, like the OpenAI stuff.
Yeah.
This is more like modern control system theory. So just like the stuff out of electrical engineering college in the last like 5-6 years, some new type of control systems. That's why it's called Allen Control Systems. Because it's like my business partner's last name is Allen.
Right.
And it's his control system.
Right.
That is the core IP. So that's like some modern AI in there. And then there's the AI on the vision system, the neural nets for seeing the drone, identifying the drone, predicting the drone's movement.
Yeah.
There's some neural nets there. So there's a bunch of different types of AI. They're like more narrow AI. We just usually call it software, you know, and what is AI?
Right.
You
know? Right. All software is AI.
It's kind of like a catch-all. I don't really like the phrase AI.
Right.
Yeah.
How did we get to this point around all of the drones being, you know, manufactured in China, not really in the U.S.? Like, where do we go wrong in the U.S. to get to this spot?
Well, I mean, obviously, I don't know if it necessarily, you know, we love open competition. And I mentioned at the start of this, you know, how the founder of DJI got started, just like any other entrepreneur. And so, yeah, we're kind of just here because of market dynamics, how we played out. They wanted it more,
yeah.
You know, built it cheaper. There's, you know, China has cheaper labor.
Yeah.
They had some structural advantages probably.
Yeah.
But it's playing out again kind of with the humanoid robots. I don't know if you've seen the humanoid robots, like the Tesla one.
Yeah.
I mean,
Aptronics.
Yeah, Aptronics. So, but like right now there's a company called Unitree in China that's far much further ahead than all of the American companies. And the product's much cheaper. The sales teams of that company call me like every week to buy them. So, and there's no way like the American companies are going to be able to compete on this. So, you know, we could have the next DJI playing out early stages now with the Chinese humanoids. Yeah.
So is there any path where we catch up and start manufacturing better here that you see?
I don't know. I mean, I don't really like think necessarily we need to. Like, I think we should lean into our strengths. We're like better at software and maybe like look to partnering neighbors for manufacturing, like, you know, closer to regions of America. Like, it's not certainly not good to manufacture at all in China. Could be our adversary, you know. But certainly, like, can we bring some manufacturing back to the U.S. into the, you know, Midwest? And can we do some with our, like, neighbors, like Mexico?
Yeah.
Things like that, where labor is cheaper, but they can be a closer ally. You know, I think that's kind of a blended approach would be good. But certainly, it's a problem, big problem.
Sure. And I'm curious what you see around the power supply of drones, and it's just, you know, more looking further down the road. Just, you know, you use like primarily lithium ion batteries today. Like, what's coming in the future, if anything?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I will say a cool story. There's a startup I met last night at one of the like mixer happy hour things, this is not really an answer to the question, but I'll just say it anyway.
Yeah.
It's a cool startup. I'll pump them. It's called Icarus.
So yeah.
It's flying close to the sun.
Right.
And they got like it's like 60,000 feet in the air and there's solar panels on it. So it's a drone that just stays in the air permanently, which I think is cool because it's so high up that, you know, it's hitting the sunlight enough during the day to just permanently stay. Yeah.
Charges.
That's a cool, it's a cool innovation on power.
How high does it have to fly?
It's like 60,000 feet.
60,000.
And then basically what they do is they do like imagery of Earth. So it's kind of competitive with space imaging companies because they're doing space imaging from space, which, you know, sometimes can be a worse picture than the Icarus, this new company. So that's kind of cool.
Very, very cool.
Yeah.
We're going to open it up for questions in a second. We'd love to hear what y'all curious about from Steven.
Could be drones or entrepreneurship.
Or entrepreneurship.
That's my favorite. That's a better topic for me. But,
yeah. Well, that's why that is, you know, a little bit of what I wanted to transition to here is you've raised a good bit of funding for this. So, you know, talk us through that and we'll maybe dive into some tips for.
Yeah.
I'm trying to do the same.
Yeah. Fundraising in the early stages is storytelling and relationships. So like the storytelling has got to be important because mostly when you first start a startup, you have nothing. You have like no product, no customer, you know, no idea. Maybe you have a prototype. So you have to like tell a story of where you're going and be really like concise with it because they don't have a lot of time to remember your story. You know, they're getting 80 pitches a week. It's got to be something simple enough where they can like be at a dinner party with their buddies and be like, oh man, I really got this pitch from this guy. He's like making a robot gun. You know, it's gotta be like, you gotta dumb it down. Like, yeah. Cause they got it. Cause they're getting so many pitches. They're inundated with so much information. It's like, that's the robot gun guys. Like, it's not gonna be one sentence.
Right.
Like, I learned that, like, very the hard way. But yeah, that's like one of the keys in the early stages. Just memorable, short, in their mind space.
Yeah, something they can repeat easily.
Yeah, something they could say at their friend's house or something. Yeah. Or when they're Tahoe, like, ski trip or whatever.
Right, right. And then once you get your attention, how do you really engage and dive in with the investor?
I mean, it's relationship building, because you're going to get rejected and they're going to maybe later, 2 years later, invest in your next round. So it's not transactional. Like, it really has to be relationship. Like, you have to talk to enough top of funnel venture capitalists or investors to find ones that, like, fit your style. And then those are the people you try to, like, give updates to, keep them warm, keep telling the story over and over again. It takes time. I mean, as the check sizes get bigger, the relationship needs to be deeper.
Yeah.
Because no one just, like, writes a $20 million check without, like, knowing who you are.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
It just doesn't happen. I've tried. Right. Doesn't work. I've tried everything.
Wish it did, yeah.
I've literally tried it all. Schemes.
Right. So you're really just taking a relational approach up front. And,
I mean, it's just,
you know, knowing it's going to take.
I mean, it is. And, like, if you, like, read the news, I used to, like, read, you know, I was first doing startups like 10 years ago. I would, like, read these articles of, like, so-and-so raises 50 million, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, how the hell are they doing this? And then if you, like, actually go, like, look who invested and then, like, look who got the money, it's always some sort of deeper connection. Like, no one's just, like, raising, like, $50 million randomly.
Right.
Yeah.
There's a lot.
Which is hard when you come from Penn State. I went to Penn State. It's hard to, like, build those relationships and shit.
Right.
It's not, like, I don't have, like, the built-in, like, Stanford network or something.
Right.
So you have to, like, you have to do it. I mean, anyone can do it. Your starting point dictates how much you have to work at it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Come from behind a little bit. But
yeah.
It's possible. You're
yeah, anyone can do it.
Above it. So who has a question
here?
Right here. Well, thank you.
It seemed like when you're doing your testing, right, you're taking down a $1,000 DJI drone every time you guys hit one. Seems like pretty expensive kind of testing to have a bunch of $1,000 drones out there. How did you get past that? You know, how do we keep from shooting down, you know, $100,000 drones?
Yeah, that's a great question. No, that's really good. I have a couple of comments there. One, a lot of times we practice on the DJI minis, which are $200, but that's even still too expensive. So what we've done is we've trained a neural net on balloons. And we tie a balloon to the drones and we shoot the balloons. Yeah, because it's the same. Like, I would just shoot balloons for people. But then, like, on real demos, like, the government wants to see drones get shot. So, but yeah, we have a neural net for internal testing for balloon stuff. That's the way. I'll also say, though, that the government, like, makes us try to, like, when we go to official government demos, they try to make us, they don't want, like, Chinese drones flying on base, which is ridiculous, by the way, for a separate reason. But like, it's not a big deal. Like, we're going to shoot these drones. Like, we want to win the war. But they're like, no, you got to buy this $10,000 drone, dog. And I'm like, I hate you guys. But we do it because we have to.
Just a related question. We produce nanomaterials, and one of the things that we're working on is better ballistic plating. and we're in Massachusetts. And in Massachusetts, if you carry just the casing of a bullet, that is equivalent to carrying a gun. So we can do a lot in Massachusetts without actually a permit, given that you're more or less from the region. Do you have to move to a place where it was, like, more gun friendly, or when you travel around with demos, how do you do?
We're in Texas because it's friendly to this. Like, I started my last company in San Francisco, moved it to New York because it was a restaurant tech company. I wanted to be near the restaurants, and this is a gun company. I'm going to be where they have all the guns, basically, you know, so. It's just you got to move around on your companies or where you're doing it. New York has the most restaurants. So it was the most people I could go door to door selling and just, like, knock on them and be like, where's the bar owner? Right. I need to talk to him today. Yeah.
I think we had a question in the back.
Yeah.
So how will you stay ahead of, like, these Chinese, essentially copycats? Like, how realistic it is to keep an edge when you have, like, a market flooded? I work with a bunch of European companies. They're also, like, doing their own thing because they feel like they can't really rely on non-EU tech.
Yeah, yeah.
So with everyone shifting, like, the EU trying to allocate their budget for their own and the Chinese copying everything you do, how can you sustainably stay ahead before someone copies your idea for half of the price?
I think that's many ways to answer that question. You know, one way to stay ahead is to start in the American market is to own the distribution channels. There are only so many government customers that procure such a new type of invention as an AI machine gun. We started first, and I've already have those relationships, and these deals are in the works. And so a new US startup trying to compete in AI guns will have a difficult time with me on the other end, just because of like where we're at. How do we prevent like the foreign adversaries? This is kind of a more exotic product than most defense tech products. So I don't know if it's necessarily buildable by the Chinese talent currently. I think they'll probably, you know, if they recovered a bullfrog on the battlefield, I think they could spend like probably 24 months reverse engineering it and get close. So yeah, I mean, they'll probably have it in like 4 years, 4 or 5 years, but they have other stuff they're gonna do. Like once this hits the battlefield, they're gonna change the, how their drones fly and stuff, because it's, you know, they have to change a lot of stuff because of this. But yeah, I'm not necessarily like counting China out from copying a product like this, but I think it's probably 4 to 5 years. And I think that this product has counters to it. So like this, you know, this product's not the end all be all for all of war. But it's just the game. That's just the game. But in the US market, I think it's already over.
This probably is a bit of a hybrid between the entrepreneurship question and the cool things about drones question, but how much have you found that you need to merge in like direct from customer elements? And I'm sort of specifically thinking of something like IFF, like identify friend or foe.
Yeah.
You as a company aren't going to get to own that, I wouldn't think, in most fields. So how do you structure that? And then from a AI and modeling perspective, sorry.
No, that was a great question. I'm trying to build as little as possible. Like I'm actually mad I had to build a search cam for this product. Like I just wanted to do the weapon station and the fire control. Because as a startup, you only have so many resources. But I tried like other search cameras and none of them like have this performance to put a bullet through a drone. Like they're not doing that same use case. So I had to build that. But I didn't want to. I didn't want to also generate my own synthetic data. Like I'm mad I have to do all this shit. So yeah, IFF, like that's good. I hope to partner with someone. Because like as little as you can do that hits product market fit, the better. So obviously I would love to reduce my R&D budget because these engineers are expensive.
Two questions. The first one is going to be economic zones. You talked about Shenzhen. Why do we not do that in the United States? Why don't we do it? You talked about with our neighbors. We don't know what the status of our neighbors are going to be at this time where everybody's kind of waiting for that to shake out. Why don't we work on economic zones that have a lower amount of regulation and, you know, steady power, steady infrastructure? That's one. And as a nuclear engineer, scientist, I forget which.
Engineer.
Small modular reactors.
Okay. First question. I might be just totally making this up, but basically, you know, we have Congress and every congressman has, you know, the ability or desire rather, the desire to improve their district, their area, their state. And so they're all like taking a slice of the taxpayer pie and trying to bring it back and get wins for their district, which is natural. And so you kind of don't get the density of manufacturing into any one particular area because you've got like a pump maker on Long Island and a valve maker in some random county in Pennsylvania. I've been to these when I was in the Navy, I would go to these vendors, but it's like really spread out because of like our structure of our government and our funding. Whereas like in a centrally planned government like China, you could just throw all the money into, you could just like say, no, it's all going here in this city. Like, I don't, you know what I mean? So like, there's just that nature of how our money flows that kind of has a much more distributed, less talent dense manufacturing and like kind of everywhere randomly. Like even where I would manufacture is, you know, kind of based on that. So I think that's probably one reason. I did just come up with that on the fly, but it sounds pretty good. Sounds right. I think it's probably right. And then small modular reactors. So I don't know. I was an electrical engineer undergrad and a master's in nuclear engineering. I kind of like the big reactors. Like I think they're more efficient. I'd rather just run power lines to the cities or to the data centers and have really giant reactors. I think that the public perception of these things is bad. And they actually are very safe. You could like run an airliner, like a Boeing 747 into a like next gen new age commercial reactor and not get any fission products spilled into the atmosphere at this point. So like, I actually think they're actually better, more efficient, but we don't have the gumption or whatever as a country to build them or something. But the small modular reactors are like a little bit of a cope mechanism, as the kids say. Like I think it's like, sounds good on paper, but I'm not, that's not where I'd be putting my investment dollars.
What else would you invest in?
I'm not a good investor. So, I mean, I'll probably be shown wrong with like Gradient Nuclear or whatever I've passed on, you know, like whatever.
Yeah.
I missed all these things, I wouldn't consider myself to be an investor. Right. My investments, they're okay. They're okay. I got one or two good ones. Yeah.
What if you don't want drones flying over your private property? Obviously, they'd be concerned about shooting down helicopters or planes or something that's not safe. But what if you did want to protect your own private property with something like this?
Yeah. So kinetic force in the U.S. is not a great market for us because like no one wants to have real bullets shooting on like U.S. soil. But there are some people making bullets that like shoot a net out, like the bullet goes out and then it like turns into a net. Like I've seen, there's some bullet tech innovation that may make it so my product can actually be sold consumer. I do think it can be sold consumer to like, you know, for like ranchers to protect their ranch, maybe like kill like auto detect boars or whatever. So we'll see. I'm focused on the war use case right now, but I do think that if there's some non-lethal bullets that get invented, then it would make more sense. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
What did you learn in your last startup, Bebot?
I mean, it's a little bit of everything, but I think the main thing is just how to assess risk. So like how to manage burn rate. You know, we're always running out of money. Every startup is running out of money until it's not. So you have to like assess how much you want to spend every month, based on it and how long it's going to last you and like what's it going to get you. So it was a really good exercise in managing burn because the restaurant people didn't have a lot of money to give us. And so we weren't very profitable. We weren't close. And just like handling the stress of that prepared me for this, which is a much longer product development cycle, much slower customer to buy, much more expensive to build. The numbers all get bigger, but the concept's still the same. And then deciding like, sometimes it's risky to not spend. You know, sometimes you just got to go for it and say, if it doesn't work, it's over.
Yep.
But like, I think sometimes you see founders underspending with what they raise. And like, they're like, they feel like I have an 18-month runway, but they really, the actual strategy of the business should have been, they should have gone to a 9-month runway.
Yeah.
They're sitting on it like a dragon hoarding their gold or something. Right. But they need to like, actually, it's risky that they're doing that.
Right. You gotta hit the boosters.
You got to go for it. Or else you lose anyway. So you're dead anyway.
Right.
So like some people don't realize that. I think I learned that lesson over my first three startups.
Yeah.
The two that failed and then Bebot that we sold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Excellent. And this company is based here in Texas. But I think you're also, you know, spending time in DC and
I just moved here. It's sweet.
Okay.
I like
officially
it.
Officially here. Yeah. Welcome.
I would consider myself to be officially here. I have a place in DC because we do the lobbying and congressional stuff. Got my toddler there, you know.
Nice.
But no, I like it on Austin. I think it's sweet. I live with my co-founder.
Really?
Yeah, we're back. I'm 38, back with my co-founder. when I'm down here.
All in on the startup.
Yeah, he has a one bedroom apartment in his house that I live back in. Right. So I watch over him.
Right.
Make sure he's safe. That's what I do. Yeah.
There's more and more companies going to DC and get involved in the government, you know, for maybe some deep tech founders that are thinking about doing this. What advice do you have for getting involved with that?
Deep tech founders with respect to DC?
Yeah.
I thought DC was more important than it ended up being.
Yeah.
Like I lived there because I thought Luke would be down here building the tech with the team and I'd be up there selling to Congress. But you really don't have to go under the hill that much.
Yeah.
So like, it's not really important to be there that much. Yeah. I didn't know when I started, because I knew nothing about doing defense tech when I started. You know, I just was like, well, all right, we'll figure it out. I thought it was like brilliant that I lived there, but it turns out it's whatever.
No, is it more?
It's actually better here because like you've got all the innovation units and then you have the ecosystem of all the other defense companies. And then everyone wants to like fly in here from the like end user level, like the brigades, like actual like military people, they have to come to Austin so they can like boondoggle or, you know, no, they're doing work. They're coming to the DIU, you know, they're doing shit, but they want to come here to eat the barbecue and stuff.
People like to come to Austin for a lot of different places.
Yeah. So then you hit them up. And so it's actually a great community. It's actually way better than being in DC for a company like this.
Yeah. There's something to be said for getting out of your normal habitat when you're trying to change things up and innovate.
So I was wrong on the selection of my geography.
Yeah.
But I've...
Well, you've corrected.
Well, yeah, you have to correct. That's every... Yeah, you're rarely right the first time on anything. Yeah. It's fast learning rate. Yeah. Fast learning rate.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, any final tips for entrepreneurs out there in 2025? Trying to make it in the world of VC.
My only tip I give entrepreneurs that are just starting for new ones is whatever you're going to do, I don't care about the idea. It's just the only thing I care about is that you mentally are prepared for 3 years until first like initial success in whatever you're doing. So you need 36 months. If you do it faster to like get your first like real strong product market fit in revenue, if you do it faster than that, then you're like ahead of the curve. But like you need to be mentally prepared going into it for 36 months of pain.
Should you just take the pain or should you find little, like maybe false summits to celebrate about or just, you know, find.
No, you gotta be a straight masochist to do this.
You just go straight in it.
Yeah, I love it.
What do you talk about in your podcast?
Oh, so my podcast is like Joe Rogan meets defense tech. So okay. I'll just be there. I don't do any prep. I just get on. I'm like, whoa, what do you do? That's awesome. Cause like you want it, like the audience is coming at the guests from a, defense tech is very like esoteric.
Yeah.
And so the audience is mostly coming at it, like they don't know anything about that company either. So if I also don't know it or pretend to don't know or like do it like that, then the audience is getting educated. So it's a lot more approachable.
Yeah.
So that's why I thought the Joe Rogan format of like where he brings people on and he lets them talk their book, like the same thing, but for defense, because it makes it much more approachable for all these confusing ass companies with all their crazy products.
Yeah.
So that's like the shtick.
Yeah.
How it works.
Yeah, and it's a lot less time than if you have to do a bunch of research.
And then I like to just feel that, you know, with dead, you know, we talk about anything. So we talk about aliens or I like conspiracy theories.
What's your favorite conspiracy theory these days?
I mean, the moon landing is always my favorite, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm assuming we landed on the moon, but I kind of want to believe we didn't.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm assuming we walked on the moon, but like, I'm not saying we didn't do it. But it's cool.
It is kind of.
I like to go deep on the YouTube rabbit hole on that. Yeah. The early Joe Rogan days, he would used to go on all those great conspiracy theory rabbit holes.
Right.
He's kind of moved away from that now. So I've stopped listening to him as much. But I used to love those.
Yeah.
Love those.
Well, there's a lot of people really are into the alien thing.
I like aliens. Obviously, aliens are cool. Witches.
Right.
All kinds of stuff.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, and where's the best place to go listen to your podcast?
Drone Ultimatum on YouTube. It's video based.
Is it?
Yeah. Well, I got to do the video.
Yeah, I only have my guests on video.
Yeah.
That's telegenic.
No way, bro. You look great. Shut up.
Thank you.
Come on.
I'm just fishing for compliments.
So. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
Join me and thank you, Steve, for coming on the show.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Austinpreneur. Don't forget to check out capitalfactory.com to learn more about us and join our community. If you have thoughts about the show or ideas on how we can work together, reach out to me directly via email, nickspiller@capitalfactory.com. Shout out to the Capital Factory Dream Team for making this podcast possible, and special thanks to Aaron Handworker, who masterfully recorded and edited the show. Come back next week for a whole new episode.